Your Steve Jones Show podcast will start shortly. The Steve Jones Show podcast is sponsored by Brewers Outlet, your beverage supermarket on Reagan Street in Sunbury. Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motor Studio, here's Steve Jones.
And if we have hit the weekend, that means a trip to Brewers Outlet, Reagan Street in Sunbury, the beverage supermarket. Imports, domestic microbrews. Did I mention beer? Yeah. What a selection. Soft drinks, snacks. They roast their peanuts every day. And the pickle bar. I love those barrel pickles. They are second to none. All at Brewers Outlet, Reagan Street in Sunbury, the beverage supermarket. We are joined by the Prince of Peace, Kevin Herr.
Hola. I thought you were going a completely different direction with that, so I'm kind of happy.
Hola, Senor Peace.
I had enough trouble with English in high school. I didn't take a second language.
There are a lot of cheap jokes I could use right now that, but I'm going to bypass every one of them.
That's kind of you. I just leave the door wide open and, you know, never forget. I never remember to lock it.
Hey, tonight, a lot of great games tonight. Selig Grove, Southern Columbia on Eagle 107. Lewisburg against Mifflinburg at Susquehanna tonight. That will be on the Valley 100.9. And Milton at Shikellamy tonight, 1380 WMLP for the Milton broadcast with Steve Williams and, of course, my man Kevin Herr, along with the coach Dick Hort.
And you know, there will be
with the call on News Radio 1070 WKOK.
I was going to say there will be television coverage of Selig Grove and Southern Columbia as well with, I believe it's Fox 56 is going to be carrying over 38, one of the two up there in that family up in the Wilkes-Barre area. So my suggestion is feel free to watch it on TV, turn the sound down, and turn up Pat and Ryan. I mean, that's what I do with Penn State games. I watch the Penn State game and turn up Steve and Jack.
Very nice. All right. So that's what's coming up. All right. We've worked out a couple of things today. Which will be interesting for you.
Oh, great.
Well, no. Michael Weinrub, who wrote the book 14 Saturdays in the fall,
yep.
As our guest, and also John Bacon, we're going to get a hold of him to discuss the Dave Brandon resignation as Michigan's athletic director. So that's what we're looking to do here. How about that? It's not bad.
No, I like that idea. You were just catching me off guard for a minute. I thought there was something I didn't know about.
Well, it's pretty much been the show for how many years now?
Hey, I wonder, are you going to be, as I switch gears smoothly.
As I walk into that one.
on your trip to Soika. On November 28th, are you going to be wearing 1976 attire? That would be attire you wore in college, wouldn't it?
Did they finally release that?
Yes.
Oh, they did? Okay. Oh, yeah. See, the problem I have sometimes is that when I do the shows and so forth, things I knew about weeks ago, oh, okay.
Nothing's a surprise, right? Yeah. You have to fake surprise.
No, I don't fake it. I always just ask, is that, did they finally say they're going to do that now? Okay,
yes.
Got it.
Yes.
No, I'm going to show up like it's 2014 and I'm going to. I don't do silly stuff like that. Just don't. I heard a conversation today that had you written all over it.
No, brother.
And this goes to the turn back the clock thing for the Penn State game. Bucknell's good. It's going to be disco fever night. They roll back the clock to 1976. Which
Steve's
going to
wear his white suit.
No, I'm not. they're going to have their 76 uniforms on. Penn State already showed their uniforms at the pep rally last week that they're going to wear for that. They actually wore them last week.
The black and pink?
Yep. Yes, sir. I heard a conversation today that just screamed you.
Okay.
It was about, what do you root for today? Do you root for the team or a player?
Well, you know how I feel about that. It depends.
Depends on what?
Depends on the situation.
See, I always root for the team. Whomever the players happen to be at the moment, okay, great, make it happen for me. But to me, it's always about the team. Individuals, hey, you know, all right, hey, look, I'm sorry to see you retire. Hey, I'm sorry they traded you. Okay. Well, who are we rooting for now?
See, for me, it depends on if they're on my fantasy team or not, and then I root for the player. Then, of course, is it a player that is one of my favorites, whether it's on my favorite team or not? And that's a difference. That's a different, you know, way to look at it. So it all depends on exactly what you mean.
Okay. What's more important to you, Troy Polamalu or the Steelers?
The Steelers.
What was more important to you 3 years ago, Troy Polamalu or the Steelers?
3 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
Probably Polamalu.
If Troy Polamalu were suddenly to go free agent and be with the Cincinnati Bengals, how disappointed would you be?
Oh, I've already lived through this. It's called Rod Woodson.
But why?
I stopped rooting for Rod Woodson when he was in Baltimore. When that ended, and then I became a fan of him again. I mean, there are some lines I just won't cross. Rooting for Baltimore, Cincinnati, or Cleveland, I do not cross those lines.
I understand that, but the individual is more important to you than the team. And I don't get that. If David Ortiz were with the Yankees tomorrow, guess what? I hope they, you know, I'd be like, hey, look, he comes to the plate against the Red Sox, strike him out.
Okay, what if David Ortiz was with the Angels?
If he comes to the plate, strike him out.
Well, I agree with that. I'm not disagreeing with that. I mean, you're asking me a question. I mean, will I follow the player to the other team and root for him then? It depends on the other team.
No, he's not there anymore. I'll sit there and go, hey, wow, I hope you do well. I really, at that point, I don't care.
No, I have a lot invested in players when I actually
root for them. No, I have nothing invested. I have zero invested in players. I've invested
No, I understand.
I've invested more in the front of the jersey.
Now, one of the problems was with the Rod Woodson was Rod was traded or released, I believe it was, 2 days after I bought the reversible jersey with Rod's number and name on it. So, I mean, I was a little bit annoyed by that for multiple reasons.
You were annoyed.
I was annoyed. Let's face it. I'm worried about me first and everybody else later, all right? I freely admit that.
And don't think I don't know that after working for 3 years.
There you go.
Thing.
See, I haven't hidden that. Yeah. No,
I thought. By the way, I thought I made my position clear. By the way, in the IndyCar thing, in my email.
But you were busy until what? 2017.
2030.
That's right. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I sent Steve an email with the complete schedule so he could follow along because he always complains about not knowing when the races are, and he said I'm busy until 2030.
And I think I speak for many. All right.
So you're asking me, do I follow the player or the team? And I say it depends on the situation. So, and I gave you an example mm-hmm. of ways that I stop following the player and would follow the team. Now, does that mean I become a fan of the new player's team? No, no. I like watching him succeed because I like this player for one reason or another.
Oh, see, I don't care. They move on, they move on. Next.
See, that's the thing that bothers me about baseball is you can't get invested in a player because you don't know how long he's going to be with that team before he moves on, and all of a sudden you have a Jim Thome jersey that's worth nothing and you can't even wear it to a game.
Okay, here's a hint for you. Okay, they tell you how long the contracts are.
Well, I know that, but when I bought the jersey, there was still plenty of time in the contract.
Okay.
So that's why I started buying jerseys with my own name on it. And let me tell you, did I get busted on for that?
Exactly.
Like, I had a no-win situation.
That's right. I mean, I'm not here to down jersey sales and things like that. No, that's not the point. Just I find it interesting where Laker fans would be through the roof if Kobe Bryant were traded.
Oh, yeah. There's no question.
Except with Kobe Bryant, they're not going to win 30 games this year in an 82-game schedule.
Well, look at Cleveland. Cleveland's a perfect example.
Well, yeah, except they dipped when LeBron James dramatically when he left. They have a chance to be great with him coming back. Kobe Bryant is still with the Lakers, and if he stays with them, they're not going to win 30 games this year.
Well, but what I'm saying is people in Cleveland didn't say, yay, go good luck in Miami, hope for the best. No, they were, I mean, it was nasty.
I understand that. I understand that. But the difference is that if the Cavaliers did not trade him, he left. They were a contender with him there. They became an absolute near-the-cellar team without him. So it's not only him leaving with them fighting for championships because they made the NBA Finals, but the domino effect is they have nothing. They're looking around saying, okay, we're going to get the first overall pick. That's just great. Is any of them going to be LeBron? No. All right. Right, exactly. Yet the Lakers could actually make themselves better if they traded Kobe.
Wonder if that's because of Laker fans just expecting to have a big name there.
No.
I mean, if he leaves, what's there?
This is part of the Kevin Hurt culture that permeates sports.
Well, but shouldn't you applaud the fact that he's made himself a part of the team so much that the fans love him?
I want the team to win, okay? If you want to trade him, get four guys that can suddenly get them to 40-plus wins and get into the playoffs, do it. Hey, going, that's great. Yeah, Kobe at 38. We're 20-60.
I think I'd rather see him retire and then try and do it that way.
Why?
I don't know. Trying to see him in a different jersey just doesn't look right.
Don't you want him to retire with his original team?
Sure, why not?
He was drafted with the Charlotte Hornets.
While looking for a vehicle, you know that if it sounds too good to be true, chances are it is too good to be true. You get the runaround, got to go from place to place. Well, you can just skip all of that and go straight to Sunbury Motor Company. Sunbury Motor Company has been satisfying more customers and selling more cars since 1915, so you know they've got it right. No offers that look good on paper or online, and then you get disappointed when you see them in person. Sunbury Motor Company offers a lineup few other auto dealers in the area can compete with. With the inventory of Ford, Hyundai, Kia, and Lincoln vehicles, there will be no problem finding the right vehicle that fits your needs and your budget. And the friendly, knowledgeable staff's ready and able to help you with everything from the test drive to the drive off the lot. See for yourself at Sunbury Motors. Sunbury Motors, Ford, Lincoln, Hyundai, in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia, Routes 11 and 15, Hummel's Wharf. Look for them online anytime at sunburymotors.com. The best get-togethers start with a trip to the beverage supermarket, Brewers Outlet, Reagan Street, Sunbury. Why? Because Brewers Outlet has not only a great selection of beer, including imports and microbrews, but also a lot more. Brewers Outlet has water, soda, they roast their peanuts every day, and you can't forget about stopping by the Pickle Bar. Look for great deals on wine coolers and all your favorite snacks. Before you enjoy those special times with family and friends, make your visit first to the beverage supermarket, Brewers Outlet, Reagan Street, Sunbury.
Taking your calls at 800-795-9565. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motor Studio, here's Steve Jones.
It's a show where you get two people where one looks at the front of the jersey and the other one's totally enamored with the name on the back. Hi, everybody. Steve Jones. Great to have you with us.
I just look for the one that makes me money.
Okay, now I'm confused.
Well, sometimes the name on the back of the jersey is on my fantasy team. Oh, wait. My fantasy team doesn't make any money even if it does win. Ah, forget that.
What's the most money you can make?
Nothing.
No, what's the most money you can make in your fantasy team?
Nothing.
Nothing.
It's just the, so you, it's the privilege you of winning an award.
You tantalize the audience with that, and then it turns out it's zero.
It's the privilege of winning an award.
Or was that a statement made to appease the police and the FBI?
I've consulted with my attorney, who's now in Las Vegas, and he says I should not answer that question.
Today's show being brought to you by Brewers Outlet, Reagan Street in Sunbury, the beverage supermarket. The snacks, soft drinks, they roast their peanuts every day. The pickle bar is unbelievable. Love those barrel pickles. Oh, did I mention beer? Oh, I have to. Imports, domestics, microbrews. Best selection anywhere. It's Brewers Outlet, Reagan Street in Sunbury, the beverage supermarket. Stock up. It's going to be a big weekend. Got plenty of college football tomorrow. Penn State, of course, at home in Maryland. Bucknell at home on homecoming with Lafayette. You got the Steelers playing on Sunday night football as Cortez Allen and the Steelers take on the Ravens.
I've never heard it being billed that way.
About what it comes down to.
Jeez.
Can he hang on by his thumbnails?
No.
It's all at Brewers Outlet, Reagan Street in Sunbury, the beverage supermarket. Of course, I'm in the Sunbury Motors studio, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors Care, which is 11 to 15, Hummel's Wharf. Next half hour, my good friend John U. Bacon to talk about the situation in Michigan where Dave Brandon resigned today and is out as of today with a new interim athletic director in Jim Hackett. We'll talk to John about that next half hour. Kevin had to turn the car in today at Sunbury Motors.
I did. The good news is it's available for you to drive. Unfortunately, I don't get to drive it anymore. And the Hyundai Azera is available at Sunbury Motors, North 4th Street in Sunbury at the Hyundai dealership. Still has the $5,800-plus discount, so that marks it down to $27,942 with power seats on both the passenger and on the driver's side. The heated seats in the front as well as rear heated seats, luxury items that you would find in a much, 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 much more expensive vehicle, and again, priced under 30 with gas mileage in a V6 that's really impressive, 30 on the highway, and plenty of room to be comfortable. You'll actually be very comfortable on a long drive in this vehicle. Check it out this weekend, Sunbury Motors Hyundai, North 4th Street, Sunbury.
And, of course, don't forget also Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. John Bacon next half hour. Few moments, Michael Weinrib, who wrote the book 14 Saturdays in the Fall. Another great book by him. All right, let's get to it. Let's bring in Michael Weinrib to talk about the book. Michael, welcome. It is great to have you with us on the show.
Well, yeah, first of all, it's fun to be back here. This is where I grew up. I wasn't born here, but I've lived here since I was 5 years old, and I don't think I would have written a book about college football if I hadn't grown up in this town. So a lot of it is infused through my memories of being a Penn State fan and growing up a Penn State fan. And I kind of wanted to extrapolate on that a little bit, and so the book is – sectioned into 14 chapters.
Yeah.
Each chapter is a different game. And the game is sort of a jumping-off point to discuss different issues about college football. You know, it's such a sport on the brink of such change right now.
Yeah.
And everything, it just seems up in the air a little bit. And so I just want to go, you know, it starts at the beginning. It starts at 1869 with the very first college football game.
Rutgers-Princeton.
Rutgers-Princeton. And then it goes through, and there's a couple of Penn State games in there because those were the games that I remember as a kid. Yeah. You know, that Penn State-Alabama Sugar Bowl in 78.
Right.
The Fiesta Bowl in 87. Yeah. You know, and it talks a lot, you know, a lot of it's filtered through my experience as a fan. And just gets at sort of the cultural history of college football and also my own personal history of college football and just what it all means and that kind of thing.
It's a history in 14 Saturdays. So you've discussed three of them immediately, which are three watershed moments for different reasons. Now let's get to the how much then went into Michael selecting the other 11 and how much, you know, what ended up on the cutting room floor versus down, because you had to make hard decisions on the other 11.
Yeah, well, part of it was, you know, you go to Wikipedia or whatever and you look up games of the century for college football. How many games of the century are there on that list? There's probably 20 on that list.
At this Oklahoma, I mean, Nebraska.
Yeah, only college football could have 20 games of the century, right?
In one season.
Yeah, exactly. So you go back and I went through that list and I thought, well, which of these games sort of carry a deeper meaning, or if there's something here that I think I can sort of use to discuss bigger ideas. So, you know, I write about, but then some of them aren't games of the century at all.
Right.
Some of them, it's like when Miami beat the crap out of Notre Dame in, you know, 1980, whatever it was, 88, 87,
right,
something like that.
That was the brawl game before the game.
Oh, actually, it might have been even earlier than that. Yeah, it was when Jerry Faust was his last game and everything.
Yeah.
But that was kind of the beginning of this Miami attitude and the Miami dynasty. And, you know, I grew up hating Miami because I was a Penn State fan. But then, you know, I sort of came around on them because I saw what they were trying to do and the way they were trying to break out of the mold of what college football was and everything
right.
like that. So I sort of, you know, have developed a grudging respect for them over the years. So that was like, I picked that game because it meant something, I think, culturally.
It was like 58 to nothing.
58 to 7 or something like that?
Yeah,
exactly. So some of those games, there's some games like that. There's some games like, you know, there's one that's, it's actually, you know, there's one game where it's like, I don't even talk about the game at all, but it's the Rose Bowl when Ohio State was supposed to go in the early 1960s, I want to say, with Woody Hayes, and the faculty decided that they didn't want to go because the Big Ten was trying to sort of, a lot of the Big Ten faculty was trying to de-emphasize football at that point.
Right.
You know? So it's more about Woody Hayes and this idea of what the Big Ten deciding what it was going to be and whether it was going to keep up with the SEC and all these other conferences. So, you know, the games, a lot of them are jumping off points, and then some of them, it's like it really gets deeper into the game itself, you know.
People don't realize that there have been those movements over time in the 60s trying to de-emphasize football. Penn State went through that period in the late 20s into the 30s where there was a de-emphasis on football. And people don't realize that there have been hurdles to overcome in that area.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a constant thing with college football. If you go back, you know, when I read about that first game, I talk a lot, you know, kind of about that, the entire 19th century and football developing in the Ivy League and Harvard and Yale. And you have the president of Harvard who doesn't want college football to exist, basically. And then you have Yale building up this power under the Walter Camp, who was kind of the first big coach. And then you have that movement you probably know about in the late 1800s when Teddy Roosevelt gets involved and there's all this violence in college football and people think maybe it's dying at that point. You know?
And Roosevelt loved football, but the violence of it, that's when they were looking. I know, and it's a different book, but Dave Refson looked into that in his book, as a matter of fact.
Absolutely. In fact, I would recommend reading Dave's book, and then mine sort of picks up where his left off,
right.
You know. I think, you know, he got out a lot of that stuff, too. But the interesting thing that he brings up and that I bring up, too, in that first chapter is that people were having the same arguments then that they're having today.
Right.
You know, the arguments about violence, the arguments about what college football's place in the bigger culture of a university is. You know, we've had all these discussions at Penn State in the last few years with everything that's gone on, you know. And it's certainly like that's part of what I wanted to do is just go back and say, you know, here's where we came from. And here's, over the years, kind of how slowly how we got here. And here's why I still have this great passion and love for this sport, even though it's so deeply flawed in a lot of ways.
The single most influential individual to me in the history of Southern football played at Southern California and not a Southern school. And that is Sam Bam Cunningham, who against Alabama scored four touchdowns. And Bear Bryant, who had been trying to integrate, had his example.
Yeah, and I think that was the breakthrough moment. And I think there were a lot of moments before that, too, where you can see Alabama slowly pushing in that direction. It's such an interesting thing.
He wanted to.
Yeah, he. I mean, apparently he wanted to back when he was at Kentucky.
Yes, Kentucky, Texas A&M, everywhere. He wanted to, Maryland.
Yeah, and so, you know, one of the years I read about is 1966, which was that year that Notre Dame tied Michigan State. Yeah. Notre Dame wins up winning the national championship, but Alabama also went undefeated that year. But they had an all-white roster at that point, and they didn't even get considered for the national championship, in part because I think they had an all-white roster, and, you know, so you can see how...
See, that was one of those games of the century, too.
Yes, Michigan, that was.
Michigan State-Notre Dame was one of those games of the century. If I recall, Coley O'Brien, Terry Hanratty gets hurt. Coley O'Brien is a diabetic.
You're right.
And they put him in, and Ara Parseghian is concerned that Coley O'Brien, you know, it's a little bit different in 1966 than it is now in terms of insulin.
Yeah.
And so they kneel on the ball, and he wins the national title.
Yeah, because there's, what, like a minute and a half left, and they've got to drive downfield. And you look at football today, and you're like, if a team has a minute and a half, that's like a full quarter at this point. You know? Yeah, exactly. It's like, why would you not go for it? There was a game a couple years ago where Alabama scored in like 30 seconds, you know, or something like that.
Right.
So, you know, but back then, it was a totally different game.
Yeah.
And so, you know, Notre Dame sits on the ball, which is probably a smart move because of what you mentioned about Coley O'Brien and everything, and also because Ara knew that if he plays for the tie, frankly, Notre Dame's going to get the vote at that point.
Right.
You know?
He knows.
Yeah, exactly. So that was part of it. And then you have that whole element with Alabama in there, too. And so the chapters I wrote about that, the late 60s and early 70s, there's a chapter about the Richard Nixon year, which I'm sure you know all about, you know, with Penn State.
Which, by the way, ESPN will be doing a 30 for 30 on.
Oh, I didn't even know that.
Yes, yeah. ESPN will be doing a 30 for 30 on the 1969 Texas-Arkansas game.
Okay, yeah, I seem to have a knack for writing about things that they then do 30 for 30s about, which I guess is a good sign.
That's a good sign.
Yeah.
It means you're on to something.
Yeah, exactly. But that was obviously such a huge year for Penn State, and it's weird to see. It's interesting to see. You know, you always, that dovetail between sports and politics is always this kind of this uncomfortable, discomforting thing. That's a moment where it was like sports and politics were directly intertwined, because Richard Nixon goes down there in order to appeal to Southern voters, not realizing that he's going to alienate the entire state of Pennsylvania by doing this.
It was Bud Wilkinson talked to him about the Southern strategy.
Right.
And that's what they came up with. What did you learn that you didn't know as you went through this?
Oh, a lot of stuff. I mean, a lot of the things, like, I had always heard the Nixon, you know, Paterno stories. I'd always heard the famous Joe line about, you know, how did Nixon know so much about college football and so little about Watergate? So I knew, like, the contours of that whole story. One thing that really interested me...
That wasn't my favorite line from him.
No.
His favorite line on this story.
On this story, okay.
Yes. He gets called by an AP writer at home. I think it's near the end of the game or whatever. I think it was at the end of the game, and they present. He said, "And your thoughts on it?" He goes, "I wasn't watching. I was babysitting." Right? Which, of course, he watched every second.
Right, of course. Absolutely. That's a good line, too. But one of the other things that surprised me, too, was, you know, I moved here to State College in 1978, and so that 78 team, that was like, you know, I was a little kid watching those games. I have very vague memories of that team and that 79 Sugar Bowl, thinking that, like, this was the hugest, biggest game I'd ever seen. It was obviously the national championship game, but if you go back and you look at that season, USC beat Alabama, and USC was a one-loss team. And USC probably should have been playing Penn State for the national championship instead of Alabama, but because you know, there was a lot of sympathy for Bear Bryant at that point. He was sort of breaking down physically. He was kind of nearing the end of his career. Mm-hmm. And I think he got a little bit of a sympathetic vote at that point. I think he knew very well how to play the politics of college yeah. football in a way that a lot of other coaches didn't. In fact, Joe often didn't play the politics mm-hmm. as well as Bear Bryant did. And I think that probably cost Penn State in some of those seasons.
Sure.
But it was interesting to look back, especially on that year, and see you know, how much nuance there was in there, and how the things that I thought I understood about that year and about that season were so much affected by other things and by politics and by all that other stuff that infiltrates college football all the time. Yeah.
What's the latest game in your book?
Latest game is last year's Iron Bowl. I had to get that in there.
You had to. Yeah.
And I think, you know, the reason I wanted to get that in there, well, not just because of the way it ended, but because it happened to Nick Saban, who is this guy who we see as sort of the ultimate modern football coach in that he's prepared for every eventuality. Mm-hmm. He's very much like a CEO or a bureaucrat or something like that, where he just kind of, you got the sense that he was prepared for everything. And then this one thing happens to him that he was absolutely not prepared for. He's got a bunch of fat guys on the field for this field goal attempt,
yeah.
and you know, and Auburn beats him, and it just kind of shows the inherent unpredictability of college football. That's why, to me, this is the best sport in the world, is because there's just that imperfection to it. There's those inherent little flaws to it that elevate it above every other sport.
Well, he called the timeout, so he could kick it.
Yeah, exactly.
He called the timeout so
yeah.
he could kick a 57-yard field goal.
Yep.
Yeah, that's people forget he's 8-7 in bowl games. I haven't. I think he's an awesome, awesome coach, but he's also not perfect.
Yeah,
that's
yeah,
my point.
It's true, but I think there was that sense that he
aura.
Was perfect.
He
yes.
has developed an aura.
There was an aura about him, and just the way he's able to recruit these days and the way that they're able to, you know, I thought this year would be the year that they would completely fall off.
Yeah,
and they're still really good, you know?
Still right in the thick of it.
Yep.
You, the 87 Fiesta Bowl is, and probably just based on how television is today, always will be the highest rated college football game ever. It had 24
yeah. something, like that.
Something
yeah.
like that. And it's never going to be approached because there's 7,000 channels on right now.
Yeah.
So you split the audience up that many ways. So when you look at that, what did that do by matching up one versus two, having the Fiesta Bowl move it to January 2nd, and give it the showcase? What did it do for the game to launch it to the point we're at now?
I think it was the prelude to the playoff. It was one of the first preludes to the playoff. Because before that point, it was pretty difficult to find to match up those top two teams. You know, it didn't happen that often. And this was a sense that, like, we are going to specifically match up these two teams. It worked out, obviously, because Miami wasn't in a
They're
conference at that point.
They were
both independents,
yep.
right? And there were a lot of independents back then. Mm-hmm. You know, the fact that they moved it back a day, the fact that you probably remember Ronald Reagan speaking at halftime, you know, mm-hmm. that sort of lent it this aura of almost being a
sure.
Super Bowl.
Yep.
You know, and it just felt like the hype for that game was so huge. The whole good versus evil thing, which seems kind of crazy in retrospect, obviously.
Yeah.
But you know, it was that was such a huge moment for me too, personally. Just yeah. you know, just the memories of that game and what it meant, and I do think it's sort of, you can draw a direct line from that game to where we are today, where we have this playoff, you know.
Well, the media surrounding it, I remember one of the big advantages that they had by inviting Penn State was actually a guy a lot of people would not think of, and that was Bud Tallman. Bud Tallman was Penn State's sports information director at the time, associate athletic director, but he was Penn State's sports information director. Bud had worked 7 Super Bowls for the NFL, and the media was the equivalent of a Super Bowl, and he knew how to handle it, all the ins and outs. That was a side story that's very important to that, because that's the kind of coverage it got.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I think, you know, Bud was obviously, he was a little bit before my time when I was here at the Collegiate.
Sure, of course.
But yeah, I mean, I think the impact that he had on that, and then the impact that some of the other people had who were directly involved with the Bowl, who managed to get that matchup. I think it was, I can't remember if it was Jimmy Johnson who didn't want that matchup.
Johnson did not want to pull, did not want the matchup.
Right, that's what it was.
He did not want the matchup. In fact, I'd covered the Miami-East Carolina game, their last regular season game, because Penn State was playing basketball in the AMI Classic, which, by the way, Penn State won. Brian Allen was the MVP, just to let you know, and anything can happen. And I mean, if you want to do one of those believe in miracles moments, that's it. But I was able to cover the game. It was Thanksgiving night.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember interviewing all their players and him, and they were not enamored with the idea of playing Penn State. They wanted to go to the Sugar Bowl.
Yes.
Which they had been destroyed in by Tennessee the year before.
Yeah, and I think what happened was one of the Fiesta Bowl officials basically baited Jimmy Johnson and
Bruce Skinner did.
Right, and he's basically said, well, okay, you guys are afraid to play Penn State, that's fine, you know, and sort of appealed to Jimmy Johnson's ego and got him to agree to that game.
I can't believe you could appeal to Jimmy Johnson's ego.
Can you imagine that?
I'm stunned by that. I'm taken aback. I'm taken aback. Just one final question, then we'll let you go. You see it come to fruition, and there's your body of work. And I recommend strongly that people buy it, because I had a chance to go in the bookstore and look through it, and I'm going to get my copy, because I think it's that good. To see it in reality, how do you feel now to see it there?
Oh, it's cool. I mean, this one feels really good to me because it was so personal, and just because so much of what I was writing about is what I picked up in this town,
yeah,
at this university, you know, and it felt like I could tell some of those, yeah, stories about my memories of those games. It's definitely the most personal book I've written,
yeah,
but even though there's a lot in there that I hope people pick up in terms of history of the game,
sure,
and history of the sport and the culture of the sport and everything like that. Yeah, it feels really good. It always feels really good to have a book out, but especially with this one where it was like you kind of,
yeah,
you know, I feel this community. Yeah,
yeah.
You know?
See, I felt like this one's personal. That's why I asked it.
Yeah, no, I think it is. I think there's a lot about growing up in this town and about like everything that's happened in the last few years has,
yeah,
been pretty emotionally wrenching, you know. And I think that's part of what this book was for me to kind of have some catharsis with that stuff too, you know.
The Season of Saturdays. Michael Weinrib, thanks so much for taking the time to carve out a couple of minutes with us, because I strongly recommend pick up a copy, take a look at it. If you love history, you love storytelling, this book has it.
Michael Weinrib joining us on the show. John Bacon, next half hour, final half hour, team versus individual. How Kevin's attitude is ruining sports.